Power on.
From the most powerful city on earth, Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.
Burger King is proud to present. In the Pits, powered by Dr. Pepper. Now, here's the Pit Crew.
Hey, good evening, race fans and hot rodders. In the Pits, race here, a little rusty.
You red rider, buddy.
I swear to God. I mean, I took off at least 2 seconds before Eric Andrews whipped me on the line right there. Congratulations to Erica, by the way, an HRA winner at the New England Nationals. Dave Reininger, we're all back from Indy. What's going on, buddy?
Oh, man, I'm glad to be sitting up straight here. It's just been doing a little sheet time, as they say.
Yeah. Craig Murto, what's going on, buddy?
How are you, Larry? Everything's doing great. Been highly entertained by all the racing I've seen this year.
Appreciate the latest copy of Late Model Racer magazine. On the cover, of course, is Race Hard, but Race Safe. Is that kind of like the mowing commercial that's on TV now?
You'll have to read it and decide that for yourself.
Okay. You know, it's not how fast you mow, it's how you mow fast.
It's a plea from a racer who hit the wall head-on at Irwindale, California, for other racers to please do the smart thing before they strap themselves in a race car.
You mean like ask the right questions at the track and stuff like that?
No, like wear the right head and neck restraint.
Okay, but you know you need to talk to the track guys about their barriers and things like that, and you know their safety crew and things like that, I would think.
Yeah, but this was his rant. I let him have it. You know,
Okay.
It's not an extensive article. It's basically his opinion.
It's not my rant, is what you're trying to tell me. Yeah, okay, yeah, I get it. Okay. All right.
Over there on the other side, Eric Jones. Eric, good evening. How are you, buddy?
Doing good. It's June, and it's like 65 degrees outside, so I'm confused.
Good horsepower weather.
Yeah.
Good horsepower weather. And to my right, the esteemed Ken Hills, back from the Porsche Club event at the Watkins Glen.
Pinky's extended.
Hey, good time
Pinky's
up there.
Extended, yes.
You know, you complained about 65. It was 50 up there.
Ooh. Snow.
Well, Epping, did they have good weather for developing?
Off and on. It was a little rainy at times, but they got it all in. And
that's a teeny tiny little track.
It is. There. It is. Not small enough to stop Courtney Force from breaking and blowing up. Mm. She had a bad blow up. Yeah. Matter of fact, there was another bad blow up on that was on Friday. There was another bad blow up on Saturday. So
they showed her on Saturday watching Ray Hall, her husband, win the first of the two races at Detroit. That was pretty cool, the whole crew standing there. Did you guys see that?
Yep.
If you watch the IndyCar race, they cut to Epping, New Hampshire, and there's Courtney Force Ray Hall with her crew, and they're all going nuts.
It was funny. Saturday before the Indy 500, I was walking down the pit road with Charlene, and there's, you know, Courtney sitting on Ray Hall's golf cart.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like non sequitur. Nobody, just by herself. I walked past, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I said, I know why you're here. And she goes, why are you here? Because if it's a big racing event, Larry O's in the house. You know what I'm saying? So that's all I said to her. I could. And John was downtown. Apparently, there's a big parade the Saturday before the Indy 500.
Know, 30 years, I've never seen it. It's a huge parade every Saturday. The Indy 500 Festival Parade. Yeah, it's absolutely huge. Every driver's in it. They have all kinds of floats and everything. Yeah, it's supposed to be really big, but I one time saw it from like two blocks away, saw like one float, and that's my extent of the parade.
I thought the Indy 500 was great this year.
That's where I figure we'd start off. I mean, we haven't had a show.
You know, one of the cool things about spending an extra week in Indy after, you know, because I hung out, you know, I got the little place out there, and, you know, I just got home yesterday. In fact, when I left on Monday, cars were running on the track. I went over to see what it was and all that. But hey, one of the cool things is being able to watch the 500 banquet.
Yeah.
And Courtney Force.
and hearing
she was absolutely stunning. No, I must say. And when Graham got up to speak at the podium, he mentioned about, you know, all the drivers, you know, knock it off. I know what she looks like.
And hearing Tony Kanaan put Lewis Hamilton in his place.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I'll tell you the one thing, the flavor of the Indy 500, not that I'm a big veteran, was quite different this year.
And
for, I mean, sat there talking with the McLaren guys on the pit road because they were doing a parade with Johnny Rutherford and Mario Andretti in the 74 winning McLaren Indy 500 car, mm-hmm. driven by Johnny, and Mario was in the 70 or 71. Mm-hmm. And these were head engineers and head engineer and a head PR person from McLaren sitting there telling us how much they enjoyed the ability to come over here and how the eyes of the motorsports world were in one place last Sunday. It was not in Charlotte. It was in Indianapolis.
And they were. And, you know, I think that has a lot to do with why Alonso won the Rookie of the Race Award, even though he was not the highest placing rookie.
I think Alonso is deserving of the award. I don't think the only criteria for the award should be highest finishing rookie. Alonso was doing stuff in practice that was absolutely amazing. I watched the stream of his tests there, which the IMS production did a great job of, you know, just one car running on the track. They had Mario, they had a bunch of people they could talk to, and it was a lot of fun to watch. Mario that first day said it looked like he'd been there 15 years, and I tell you, a week later, it looked like he'd been there 20 years, and you know, like a couple of days later, he was doing stuff you don't see any of the other guys do. So he was diving in off the short chutes into 2 and 4, passing people where you generally don't see passes being completed.
And, of course, the controversy for some people is that Ed Jones, also a rookie, finished third in the race. But this is not the first time it's happened. Graham Hill won the race as a rookie, but Jackie Stewart won Rookie of the Race that year.
He probably brought all the ladies donuts every morning. That's how that works.
Well, he also was leading the race going away with about 3 laps to go when I think it was an oil pump broke.
I think Ed Jones did a fine, fine job, especially driving a Dale Coyne car in his rookie season at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to finish third is quite a great feat and well deserving of the Rookie of the Year. But, you know, I can't argue against Alonso. I think both would be well deserving of the award. It went to Alonso. That's the way it is.
Yeah, I don't think many people, some people, the purists had a problem with it because they did think it should have been the highest finishing rookie. But I'll tell you what, Alonso added so much more flavor to that particular event.
And that's the criteria. I know when I was on the committee the first time I joined the committee, they sat us all down and they said, you know, this is not the highest finishing rookie. This is how they deal with the media, you know, how they deal with the fans, you know, how they go out and practice, you know, how they handle themselves throughout the whole month on television, like I said, with the media, things like that. So it's an award that awards the overall performance in the month, and I think Alonso is the man there.
And, you know, we haven't done a show since Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, Monaco was intriguing for the simple fact that Mercedes wasn't even on the podium.
Yeah.
That made Monaco quite intriguing. And then the 600 at Charlotte was actually a pretty entertaining race.
Mm-hmm.
The 600, I thought, was more entertaining than the All-Star race.
Yeah.
Eric, I mean, what did you think about it?
The car that won was the one that, you know, completed the distance first. So,
how profound.
That's how the winner is. Yeah.
That's how the winner is determined. I disagree. I thought both races were boring. I thought the All-Star race was boring, and I thought the 600 was boring. I thought the best race of the weekend was the Indianapolis 500, very, very quickly followed by Ferrari's performance at Monaco.
And there were quite a few cautions in the Indianapolis 500, I forget. So did somebody say 40 laps? I haven't seen the box score in a week or so.
Close to a quarter of the race, yeah.
Okay, and that's too much. But, boy, when it came down to it at the end there, you know, the last 10, 15 laps, you know, with Jones and, you know, you had the 8 car out there with the young kid from Formula One that's driving for Ganassi.
Chilton.
Max Chilton was running out front. And, you know, I knew those guys could pressure Chilton and get by. And, you know, Sato, who's so, so hungry for a win anywhere. And an interesting point was made after the race at the house when, you know, somebody said, well, Sato's a crasher. And somebody was very quick to reply that, you know, he always crashed for position.
That's right. That's right. And what is his saying? Something like, I'm paraphrasing, something like, you don't take a chance, you don't get the game. Like,
yeah.
I'm paraphrasing because I don't recall
it exactly. No buttle. I've seen the Japanese T-shirts. It says no buttle or no reward or something. It's some kind of, what do you call the Japanese English? It's absolutely hilarious, some of the T-shirts over there. But I will say this. Every time we went to the Motegi, we had the most informed fans of anywhere in the world, and you couldn't tell those folks anything. They knew all about the cars. They knew all about the drivers, and Sato is an absolute rock star over there. They had to take a minivan, and they had these, you know, containers, shipping containers that were turned into offices. I'm sure you've seen them on construction sites, and that's what they were using for offices for the teams, and they had to cordon off an area where the minivan could pull in and Sato could get out of the minivan and into the office. Well, you know, under supervision, they finally let him out to sign some autographs, but he is an absolute rock star in Japan.
And that, you know, it's not like Craster Maldonado, you know, where he's or like Kenny Habul in freaking IMSA, or actually anything Kenny Habul drives, where, you know, he's in over his head and is completely ruining other people's races because he lacks the talent. Takuma Sato, especially at the ovals in AJ Foyt's cars the last several years, Takuma Sato has been, you know, running towards the front until, you know, something happens and a mistake is made. So that's why I think there's two reasons why Takuma's win was so popular at Indianapolis. One was because of his Japanese fan base, but two, because he is one of the good guys that's always been there. But then the return of AJ Foyt Racing to Indianapolis Victory Lane was also a huge part of that.
Andretti
now. Dang it.
He followed the
Honda. I totally messed that
up.
Yeah, what you just said is something that my brother and I discussed, which is it's a shame he didn't win that race for AJ Foyt. But of course, when AJ
switched. You know what? I just equated it to AJ Foyt, though. So, I mean, whatever. It's all the same thing.
When AJ switched over to Chevy, you know, Honda went and got him to ride.
Why didn't you stop me?
But, you know, I didn't know where he was going, but.
Here's the great.
I look like an idiot.
Here's the great part. That car, the Andretti car, was owned by a local guy, David Tilton from Primtech, over in Ashburn, who also owns the Prime. What is it? Prime Steakhouse downtown.
Yep, DC Prime.
DC Prime. Mm-hmm. Great guy.
One loud.
Knows us from Andretti through the Global Rallycross because he also sponsors Scott Speed, and he's a big fan. He sponsors Tristan Herbert when Tristan runs in. What was Tristan running in the?
He was running PWC there for
PWC,
a while.
PWC, right?
And then, but he also sponsors the series entitlement sponsor for Mars.
Yeah, for the Mid-Atlantic Road Racing Series. I mean, the guys. I mean, we saw him on Saturday. He's standing there and he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him. David, he goes, Larry. I said, "What are you doing dressed up?" He goes, "I bought the Andretti car, Takuma Sako's car." Takuma came over. We got introduced around Charlene and I. And I said, well, good luck tomorrow. So he wanted us to come down on his pit box. I said, damn if I did not do it. But in the meantime, there he was in Victory Lane. He came over to me and said, can you believe this? I said, no.
Interesting absolutely. Article written by Jeff Olson, who pretty much writes for the IndyCar webpage. And, you know, the old journalists, you know, they sneer when there's any cheering or anything in the press room. But he wrote, you know, this time it was okay. Not only okay, well-deserved, because these guys, they come over here, they cover Takuma Sato, you know, they go to a race. Sometimes when there's a race a week apart, they fly home to Tokyo and then fly back, and all the time that they put in covering the series and, you know, all the people that, you know, just pour over every word they write, you know, every story that they do on the radio or on TV. And to finally have these guys have their guy win, there was a corner, Larry, as you know, up in the front of the press room with Japanese journalists. And they got up and did everything but weep. And I believe a couple of them might have wept. And they were hugging each other and crawling over each other. And while the old and crusty journalists, you know, might sneer at that, I think everybody, you know, may have a little tear in their eye or knew exactly where all that was coming from. A
couple items from my perspective. Number one, when Alonso's car broke, there was a unified oh my God, sigh out of the media. I mean, just everybody was on the edge of their seat watching him to see if he could actually pull this off, because he had told us on Saturday in a post introduction press conference that he had first come to race. He wanted the dynamic and the ability to run the Indy 500. Mm-hmm. And then as he got more comfortable during the month in the car, he said, my attitude changed. He said on Saturday, I am now here to win. And I was like, okay.
But of all the Hondas to fail, it had to be Alonso's.
He got the wrong motor, didn't he?
Yeah, he said that. He said, if my motor is still running at the end of the race, I will be up there.
You know what I find ironic about Indy the past half a decade or so? Hasn't Andretti Autosport pretty much won, like, what, five out of the last six Indy 500s? And when you look
at... Let's see, they won last year with Rossi. They won 2013 with Ryan Hunter-Reay. And I'm drawing a blank all the way back to, like, you know, 2007 with Andretti Green, 2005 Dan Weldon, Dario Franchitti. But, yeah, Ryan Hunter-Reay and Rossi and now... Sato.
And so they pretty much have Indy dialed in, and it's just kind of ironic given all the bad luck that's associated with the Andretti name at Indy.
It's very similar. The drivers are very similar in age to the drivers now in the NASCAR Monster Cup Series, because you've got an aging group of drivers and you've got a new group of drivers. The new group of drivers, I mean, they've got some heroes down there. You know, Rossi's a hero. I mean, people look for great things out of him over his career. NASCAR, there's not that many younger drivers that are potential heroes at this particular point, maybe two or three. But Helio Castroneves said after the race that he wanted to win really bad, because that would have been, what, his fourth or something like that.
He would have joined that club, yes.
He would have joined, and he was very magnanimous about it, but you could see he was genuinely upset to the point of being pissed off that he did not win.
Because he was right there.
He was.
He had the lead. He was right there. He was racing for the lead with those guys.
Yep.
And, you know, just didn't have the car to hold off Sato.
Oh, he tried, though. Remember, he got back up alongside Sato, and Sato was like, not this time.
And, you know, I have to say something. Maybe I shouldn't say it. Shirley would probably be cringing if she was sitting here. The fact that there was some scuttlebutt in and amongst the media in some cases, and also some fans that thought on Memorial Day, no Japanese person driving a Japanese car should win that race.
I think that was just one journalist out of Denver that
what
caused
our
that
resident fuss. Patriot,
and he got fired.
Yeah, I don't know.
We'll have to wake him up later. But that's appalling. Absolutely appalling. That somebody would say something like that.
This I know.
Is the land open. You get there's a Statue of Liberty. You read the thing in her arms there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the whole thing is that, you know, let's not live in the past. Let's not live in the way past. I mean, I appreciate history as much as anybody. I got a sheepskin at home that sits there.
Yeah,
says
we're talking
I know
70
about.
Years, pal.
Yeah.
The war is over. Okay.
I mean, you know, this is an international sport now, and it was absolutely proven at the Indianapolis 500 that it is an international sport. There were drivers there, I think, from five different continents, okay, and none of which were chumps. You know, when everybody's driving around at 222 miles an hour average speed or better, that's fast. And let me tell you, when you're standing there, David, I got to thank you again for this, for the ability to go to the Indy 500 and stand outside of the media center out on that ledge and watch these guys come by nose to tail, door to door, not that they have doors, at 220 miles an hour down the front straightaway. That's balls, man. That is incredible.
I have a question for Ken. Ken, you saw the accident Scott Dixon had, right?
Yes.
You saw the photographer right up along the fence. Did you think of the movie Rear Window?
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody did get hurt taking picture of that wreck.
Yeah, but he wasn't hurt badly.
Not badly, but
yeah, he was a photographer that was right there where the fence got ripped down.
He went off on a stretcher.
He went off on a stretcher, but he was tweeting his friends when they were hauling him off.
You know, I'll be honest with you. When I get out there to take pictures, the first thing I do is plan my escape route. Not that you can really see anything other than what's through your lens.
Mm-hmm. Well, in most cases, it's Jersey wall laid down, you know, and hopefully they don't land on top of the Jersey wall.
Now, for those who are not familiar with it, the reason I mentioned Rear Window is because that movie, the photographer who's recovering from a broken leg in his apartment, and that the whole story takes place there, he got hurt filming a racing accident, because they show you at the beginning of the movie, they show you the accident he was shooting when it happened.
By Raymond Burr.
Let's not leave Indy, because 2 weeks prior to the 500 was the Grand Prix. Michael Schladen was there, And Michael, I've not seen the road race course even at Indy. So how was that?
That whole event was really good. It was my first time to Indianapolis, so we made it to the museum on Thursday. There's practice qualifying Friday, and then the race Saturday. The race itself was really good. I went with my dad. We were sitting right at turn 1, 2, 3 complex, and the turn 4 grandstand.
Yeah.
But I mean, those seats were great. You could really see a lot of the action. I mean, if you compare it to, for example, watching the race in Baltimore, however many years ago that was, because it's a street circuit, you know, you're only able to see such a small portion of
sure.
it.
Sure, there's no comparison.
Yeah, so, I mean, this was the only other IndyCar race, road course race I've seen, and it was great. You know, even though the race was caution-free, there's still a lot of good battles on track, and Will Power ended up with the victory. So it was a pretty good race.
Good.
Well, I said on Facebook the weekend of the 500 that if you're a race fan, you need to go to the 500 at least once. I mean, it is serious.
Wait a minute. Where did you go to eat, Michael? Did you make it to Charlie Brown's?
No, that was on our itinerary, but sadly we didn't make
working
it.
Working man's friend?
Yeah. No.
Did you not go to the working man's friend?
No, we went to Steak and Shake.
Where?
Steak and Shake.
Proud sponsor of Graham Rahal.
Yeah.
That's right. Did Rahal give you $5 coupons to Steak and Shake?
No.
Hey, you know what? This is the first time I've ever been to Indy and did not go to a Steak and Shake. We stayed at the Chateau Reininger and basically just hung out, ate there. We never even went over to Speedway to go to A.J. Foyt's Wine Bar.
Yeah, we missed that too.
We just hung out at the house. It was just too much fun. Plus, the place was packed. I mean, it was I'd been there
500?
Years ago.
It said something like
everything.
Everything was packed. Has this turnaround that they're trying to do on Main Street has been successful and is now going from successful to, you know, really cool place to be. You know, okay, let's get these apartments done in here. And there's a lot of great restaurants in there. There's some little cool stores, some antique shops. But
you're talking in Speedway.
Downtown Main Street Speedway, you know, Sarah Fisher's Speedway Indoor Karting is open. You know, the Lara Factory is open. Ed Carpenter Racing on one side of the street. So you have these three big buildings on one side of the street. And the other side of the street is the original Old Town Speedway where they've kept the shop fronts. And, in fact, there's a little store there that's a soda pop and candy store where you can go in and buy, you know, old Dr. Brown sodas or old Cheer wines or, you know, all the old retro sodas. And Laura goes in and she's looking for candy. I'm looking to look. Wow, I said, these are the original floors. The guy goes, yeah, and the original ceiling and everything else. So, you know, it's kind of neat to see those buildings being repurposed and put to good use and being patronized.
Something I want to add also from the NDGP weekend, they had a post-race track invasion. So after the race finished, they had a whole bunch of gates that you could get on the track, and they had the podium celebrations, and I really enjoyed that. I mean, walking down the front stretch at Indy for the first time, that was pretty cool.
Did you have a flag or anything on your shoulders?
No, I did make it down to the bricks and got some photos there. So
did you kiss them? Cool.
Yep, I did.
They're salty, aren't they?
Yeah.
I only kiss them if I have to.
I kissed the bricks, but I couldn't tell you what the flavor was.
You're not supposed to use tongue.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Jeez, a flip.
I'll tell you one thing I really like. I find interesting about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It's the fact that they reverse the direction of the track depending on who's racing there.
Yeah.
Which I think is pretty neat.
And those guys are, they have the SVRA out there this weekend?
Yeah,
I know they have F4 coming in, and then the SVRA, and they, as I was leaving, they were putting up all the Brickyard signs, the big Brickyard sign over the main entrance on 16th Street. So.
Well, you know, there was some talk, and I guess there's always talk about bringing Formula One back to Indy as being the most viable track in North America to run Indy. I know it was a disaster the one year with the tire situation.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think they would bring F1 back? I'll throw that
out.
Well,
I think Liberty's open to it, the new owner. So, you know, it all depends.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be financially feasible.
Yeah, the problem back then was between Bernie and Max Mosley. Neither one could make a decision.
Okay.
They should have, when that year they had that problem at Indy, they should have just put in a chicane.
Yeah, seriously.
Would have solved the problem.
Yeah. Seriously. I mean, they had a vote with all the teams, and I think Ferrari was the only one who didn't want to put in a chicane. So, yeah.
So that's why Max didn't let him do
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So I think Formula One will come back, and they'll have a second race in the U.S. in the next couple of years. I don't think it's going to be at Indy, though.
Where do you think?
Probably some major city. I know New York isn't going to happen, but something West Coast maybe. I don't know. Just where the market is.
What's that, Eric?
Laguna Seca is, I think, a possibility.
It would be a hit on the West Coast.
I think, you know, some sort of a hybrid street circuit with a parking lot section where they can do some cool stuff. Because you remember the first D.C. Grand Prix, that was, they would call it a street race. But it was in a parking lot,
yep.
And it was a purpose-built road course, had runoff and curbs and everything else, about yep. purpose-built road course in the city, in a parking lot.
Yeah, I lament that. I lament that, and I lament the Baltimore Grand Prix. At least they had two races in Baltimore. We only had one here in D.C., and both races were stellar events. I don't know if there is a possibility for new street racing in the United States anymore.
Depends where it is. They were going to have that Formula One race across the river from New York City, just never happened.
Yeah, and Formula E is coming to New York, and I believe somewhere in Brooklyn, right along the water in July.
Nobody complains about the noise of a Formula E race.
Yeah, that's not going to be. No one's going to have to pack earplugs for that race. So
yeah, it's just. I don't know. I think there's an opportunity for good street racing, but I don't know where it could be now.
Well, sometimes I think the promoters are part of the problem. If you're going to have a race in someone's neighborhood, then give people within a certain distance of the race course free admission to the race.
I mean, I don't want to beat this dead.
They can't complain if you let them in free.
They did that. They did. You ask Kane Dominic. Kane Dominic will tell you, and Chris Lincheski, what they did for the citizenry that lived in the immediate vicinity of Robert F. Kennedy
Stadium.
And
they still didn't want it.
You know their problem?
Oh.
The Washington Post.
Yeah.
The sports section loved it. The style section killed it.
Yep. And the problem was half the people that they gave tickets to scalped the tickets. Okay, fine. That's your choice. They were also given condominiums to rent, but given condominiums in Ocean City, Maryland for the weekend. Here you go. Go to Ocean City on us. Okay. Half of the fencing in the back that was basically tarped so you couldn't see through was cut down so that people could see through. The neighbors could see through the fencing to watch the race.
The style section of the Post got people all riled up. There were rumors that the Georgetown law students were getting together and just, as a student project, like, say, if we can shut this thing down. I mean, it was absurd.
And they came out and said that the decibel level for the Grand Prix was so high that it violated any ordinance in the city of the District of Columbia. Guess what? The Redskin fans at RFK were twice as loud as the cars were. That's a fact, Jack.
And that was the Redskins playing crowd noise through the PA system because half the Redskins fans are sitting there on their thumbs.
And I'll tell you what, Dave's exactly right. It was politically killed. And I'll be honest with you, and I'll go out on a limb. It's been so long. They paid off the wrong D.C. people in business. Because the next year, the D.C. Sports Council flipped, and the guys they had paid off to get the race in there were gone. And that, Dave, that's the truth. I hate to say it, but that's the truth. I'm not mentioning names.
Hamana. Talk to my buddy Vinny on Staten Island about that race.
You know, none of this, nothing surprises me anymore.
Oh, Craig just did a mic drop.
Did you see that? Are we live on Facebook?
No, we're not live.
Do it again.
No.
Do it again, Craig.
I'll do it again with the mic on, then that way you can hear it. At least get the audio out.
Okay, let's shift gears. Let's talk about the real butt in motorsports right now. Kyle the Butt Bush, okay? What is wrong? Eric, what is wrong with that boy?
He wants to win.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with wanting to win.
I understand that, but to sit there and become...
Oh. If he had one more lap, he would have won.
Let me tell you something. Everybody went off about Kyle Busch and how he reacted to in the media center fall in the Coca-Cola 600. And I like Bob Pockers. Bob Pockers is a very fair journalist.
Absolutely.
However, Bob Pockers should have known better than to ask Kyle Busch a question like that, and that be the very first question of the media post-race media availability. To have a guy that just barely lost out on winning the first points race he would have won at Charlotte Motor Speedway, and what's eluded him, one of the few tracks
for the uninitiated such as myself. Who figured he said something about Sato winning on a Memorial Day, because I don't know any better. What exactly did he say?
I was getting ready to get to that.
Kyle Busch did what I just did.
So Kyle Busch comes in the media center for his post-race availability. Mm-hmm. He finished second. The guy hates losing. And Bob Pockris opening up the media availability, mm-hmm. Bob had the first question. He said, what do you think, Austin? I'm paraphrasing at this point. What do you think Austin Dillon's win means to him? And Kyle Busch was like, are you serious? And, literally said, nothing surprises me. And
he slammed the mic. He said, I think he was asked,
are you surprised that Austin Dillon won?
And what do you think about his victory? And Kyle said, nothing surprises me anymore. Congratulations. And dropped the mic down, and that was the end of it.
But, what didn't work
I
is,
like it.
I don't have a problem with it. But the reason why there was such outrage, there should have been more outrage over Bob Pockris asking Kyle Busch that question. But the reason why there's so much outrage, I don't understand the negativity towards Kyle Busch from the broader NASCAR fan base. And what it goes back to is, 2008 at Richmond when him and Dale Earnhardt Jr. got together and he spun Dale Earnhardt Jr. in turn three. That right there is why the NASCAR fan base hates Kyle Busch.
9 years later.
Yeah, and they still, because the majority of the people that are Kyle Busch haters and don't appreciate what that man can do behind the wheel of a race car are Dale Earnhart Jr. fans.
If it was Dale
Earnhart Jr. that said that to Bob Pockris during the media availability, he would have been applauded.
Yeah, but you know what gets me is people got to put themselves in Kyle Busch's shoes, though, because look, you just drove your butt off, and he thought he was making last lap pass for the win. I mean, he passed to get into second on the last lap, and it should have been the battle for the race, except that the Childress team with Austin Dillon out-strategized everybody, and he saved enough gas to limp across the line in first. So Kyle Busch thought he was winning the race until he got up to turn four on the last lap and was told you're going to finish second.
But I think the other thing that you have at play there with Kyle Busch is, he just got you have all those emotions, you get out of the race car, and it didn't help him out that, he gets out of the car, he goes in the media center, and he's sitting there and he's, picking out his nose, waiting for, the NASCAR IMC representative to finish up the introductory remarks for the media availability. He's got a camera on him, and everything's just so scrutinized now. I don't have a problem with his demeanor. Inside, that's the same guy that when he's in the race car and he's sitting at Texas on pit road after being penalized, and he's telling the NASCAR official he's number one. Kyle Busch had him and Kurt Busch, and NASCAR has actually been using a commercial with them talking about. The fans need people like Kurt Busch. They need people like Kyle Busch because the fans hate him. They're the villains of the sport, unrightfully so, in my opinion. But that these guys just want to win. That's all there is to it. And he's got passion. He's not a robot, and I can appreciate that.
Humankind's age-old story, the good guys versus the bad guys.
Yeah, I mean, at Bristol.
Well, we need it. We do need it.
At Bristol in 2012, I was very, very fortunate and was able to stand in the back of the pickup trucks during driver intros with Kyle Busch through a deal with Speedway Children's Charities. Kyle Busch and Marcus Ambrose, and sitting there having a conversation with Kyle Busch.
Wait a minute. You got to ride around the truck and
I got to stand in the back of the truck with them.
You know what? We never got to do that.
Go ahead. Finish the story.
Yeah, seriously.
Go ahead.
But the fans were just nasty. Just really, really nasty to Kyle Busch. Shouting all sorts of obscenities, throwing beer, all sorts of stuff. This is pre-race. This is pre-race driver intros. And I said to him, I was like, what is that? What goes through your mind? And he goes, it motivates me. He goes, I love the haters. And he really does. Like, that's what motivates him.
Hey.
Is to perform.
As long as they're doing something.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kyle Busch isn't your typical silver spoon kid that came in and just rose up the ranks on daddy's money. Because he may have had dad's money by Dick Cobb to be his crew chief in Las Vegas or that type of thing. But Kyle Busch, whenever I've seen Kyle Busch at a racetrack, it's a short track. He's got a super late model, and he's getting dirty working on it.
Yeah. I mean, the guy drives a race car, and he just wants to win. Like I said, I appreciate that tenacity.
In the beginning of his career, when he first came into the Cup Series, I sat there and watched this kid race and said to myself, I've seen this guy race before. And people were asking me, who? And I said, Dale Earnhardt Sr. He raced the same way with the same freaking attitude. Craig, what did you think?
I thought he's more like Darrell Waltrip.
All right, maybe.
Because he runs his mouth and goes out there and runs with the attitude.
But he doesn't – Darrell Waltrip would run his mouth before the race, and he'd go out and beat everybody's ass. Kyle Busch runs his mouth when he gets out of the race car.
The Busch brothers are their own individual – they're their own deal.
I agree.
Kurt's calmed down a lot in the past few years.
But Kyle Busch, I mean, like I said, his tenacity behind the race car, he does remind me a bit of Earnhardt in the late 80s. Earnhardt in the late 80s, not Earnhardt in the mid 80s or early 80s. He's a whole race car driver. But, you know, here we are in June. We're 12 races down into the season. Who would have thought that Joe Gibbs Racing would have one win, essentially?
And Richard Childress has
and
two.
And that's the all-star race.
Yeah.
Joe Gibbs Racing hasn't won a points race. Nope. Joe Gibbs Racing is not locked into the chase this year.
And Richard Childress would have both their drivers in victory.
And RCR has two of their drivers in. Don't forget about Wonder Boy, Moneybags, Paul Menard. So, anything's possible.
Well, he could still win. Mileage. He won the Brickyard 400 one year.
He can win a fuel mileage race just like Austin Dillon can as well.
Yeah, well,
I think it's interesting when you look at it.
He won the Brickyard 400 going away.
It was on a fuel mileage.
I don't think so.
Paul Menard won the Brickyard 400 on a fuel mileage race. And
it's
Austin
still,
Dillon,
you know what? It's still winning.
It is still a win. Danica Patrick is proof of that one. But, you know, when you look at RCR and some of the stuff that's been going on there, you know, I'm concerned. They were performing really, really well last year. Austin Dillon in the three car was with Slugger Labby. When Slugger said, hey, I've had enough, I want to come off the road, when he was Paul Menard's crew chief, came off the road for a little bit, ended up coming over and working with the three car. And all this year, that three car, they've been decent. They ran decent, you know. Top 12-ish, usually. But Austin Dillon's temper tantrums on the radios, that's the whole reason why Slugger Labby quit. I mean, that kid is the reason why Slugger Labby quit RCR.
He's not alone in that, because temper tantrums on the radio is also something that fans who use scanners complain about the Busch brothers for.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. You know, there's a little bit different of an optic there. Or perspectives with...
Well, some are whiny, some are anger.
Yeah.
You know,
But Austin Dillon, straight up temper tantrum. I mean, when Andy Houston, his spotter, who is, I think, one of the best race car drivers that just never had the right opportunities, when you look at Andy Houston, and he's frustrated with that kid, I think that Austin, you know, needs to take a look in the mirror and figure out, you know, is he doing it because he loves the sport and he loves racing, or is he doing it because it allows him to live a rock star's lifestyle with a gold plated Camaro and private planes and your initials in your pool?
And so, you know, I'll tell you, although
they're just like us,
I'm not a huge fan of the Dillon brothers, but I've always thought Austin has demonstrated more ability than Ty. After all, he's won the Camping World Truck Series title, he won the Xfinity title. And now he's in Cup, and he's the first one to win a race in Cup out of the two brothers. However, Ty, I know he wrecked out in the end, but he impressed me at Dover.
Yeah, I mean, towards the end there, he was what, running fourth when he ran out of talent? Third or fourth?
After leading the race, though.
I tell you, the person that impressed me at Dover was Kyle Busch. I mean, they sit there and have that screw up on the pit road. The tire was not put on the car, rips out the left rear quarter panel. He goes out of the pit road, turns around, comes back, goes two laps down, and then what did he finish, like fifth?
I don't know what the what it was.
Pretty high.
The running. He came back and was leading laps after the damage to the car, which, thankfully that damage was on the left rear of the car, not the right rear, because the right rear is where they're doing all the funny business. So if that had happened on the right rear, he wouldn't have been able to get back towards the front, I don't think.
Now, let me throw this at you, Eric. You know that the Keselowski truck team and the Joe Gibbs Cup teams, they handed down penalties because of those tires that came off on the pit road incidents. Yep. And, of course, I don't think NASCAR had any option. What they did was they suspended the crew chief, the tire carrier, and the tire changer on both those teams, the Truck Series and the Cup Series, for four races because of having the tire come off. Yep. But it seems to me that rule was written back in the day when they were finding some teams putting as few as two lug nuts on the tires, and that the rule was actually meant to keep that from happening. Do you think they'll revisit this rule at the end of the season to maybe make a change, like if it happens under green on the racetrack versus if it happens on pit road?
I don't think so, and here's the reason why. If NASCAR, so they better not change the damn rule in June. If they're going to change the rule, they need to do it in January, number one.
Well, that's why I said when the season's over.
Yeah, but I think one of the other things that I look at with that is, I don't want NASCAR to be in the business of judging intent or attempting to determine intent. And I think that, the rule's black and white. A wheel comes off the race car, the crew chief, the tire changer are suspended for four races, and they stuck to it. So I will applaud NASCAR, because that is the one thing that I've always bitched and complained about, is the lack of consistency from the tower and from from NASCAR itself and how they handle things.
I agree with you there, but I was just wondering if maybe, given that now we see the situation of the tire coming off can also happen because of a miscue on pit road, do you think maybe they'll rewrite the rule to make it 2 to 4 races instead of just straight up four races?
No.
To give themselves some leeway.
And I hope they don't, because that gets back into the judging of intent and things like that. I want NASCAR to, if that's the rule, don't have all these different, hey, if it's on pit road, if it's on the race, if it's under green.
You want them to be black and white. Here it is. You failed.
That
done.
Rule needs to be black and white, because the thing is it comes back to attention to detail and safety. If that tire comes off on pit road, it doesn't matter if it's under green or under yellow or what. The team needs to take the time to slow down and make sure everything's there. Because the whole reason why we have this rule is because drivers started accusing NASCAR of not caring about safety.
And I do agree with you that it's good that NASCAR didn't do what a lot of fans are saying, which is, why didn't they just give them a break? They didn't mean to do it. Well, no. You criticize NASCAR when NASCAR does it.
Yeah. But what would have happened if it was Dale Earnhardt Jr.?
Yeah.
You just hear louder people screaming about it.
Would Greg Ives be suspended? Who knows?
Oh, I
would
think
hope so.
Yes.
I would hope so.
I hope so, too.
Let's talk about some midseason shakeups. First of all, Jack Roush basically parking his Xfinity car. I mean, lack of money, obviously. Okay.
No, it's somebody ran out of money.
All right, ran out of money.
That's what that is.
But, I mean, we're seeing a lot of that occur now. Ray Black Jr.'s out of that car.
Ran out of money.
The whole thing's, it's tilting a little bit the wrong way at this particular point, this time of the season.
Here's what it comes down to. The sport's too damn expensive. It is too damn expensive. We've been talking about this. We've been talking about this now for how many years? That, the car.
17 for some of us,
But the car counts and everything else. The sport is too damn expensive.
From top to bottom.
Yeah. From the highest levels of the sport, at all levels of motorsport, all the way down to your local grassroots racing, whether it's guys that are running midgets or guys that are running street stocks, it is all too damn expensive.
I mean, we're talking $55,000 for a sprint car motor, $6,000 to $9,000 to freshen it up after 500 laps. And in a lot of cases, that's like 10 to 15 races. So depending if you've got a pretty long season, you're going to get that thing freshened up a couple times and then want to get it freshened up at the end of the season. So you've spent 55 times plus 21,000, you're like $80,000.
Meanwhile, you've got the IMCA Race Saver cars, which are the fastest growing segment in open wheel racing. There's a couple of racetracks that swear that by going to those cars, they've saved their sport, because now they have more sprint cars running those 305s than they ever had. Mm-hmm. And I saw Satch Worley win a race at Old Dominion Speedway on a $500 junkyard motor running those Race Saver rules that hadn't been freshened in 3 years.
And they're not bad on a short track, but God forbid you run them with a 410 show, because, you know, people are going to go, what's that junk? You know, because the 410s are absolutely incredible. And if I could just segue to next week in Central Pennsylvania, USAC makes a swing through with sprint cars, starting with Grandview on Tuesday night, Lincoln Wednesday, and then Thursday and Friday at Williams Grove before heading over to Port Royal. So that's next week. USAC sprint cars, in many cases, running with the ARGC midgets, which are running topless. So sprint car racing next week. I'm sorry to segue there with that.
No, that's a good one. No. Because, like, you know, we're talking about it, it's, you know, a Legends car, $30,000 a year. We were doing it on the cheap. $30,000 to run 17 races at Old Dominion Speedway.
In a car that was promoted as by a Legends car, inexpensive racing.
Yeah. The
intro was cheap back in the day.
But here's what has ruined the sport. The money has ruined the sport. The kids chasing that NASCAR money has completely ruined the sport. The dads chasing that money has completely ruined the sport. Dads that are throwing their kids in go-karts at 3 years old have ruined the sport. That is what's ruined the sport. That is what is making racing not enjoyable.
When I grew up, your local racetrack was middle-aged guys that had to put food on the table. Now you go to your local racetrack, and you've got 13-year-old kid who probably won't be there next year, because next year he'll be in a K&N car.
Yeah. But that is the very fundamental problem that we have in the sport today. And that is why these teams are shutting down. Red Horse Racing shut down. Which is, like, Tom DeLoach has been, you know, a staple of the truck series. And, you know, wasn't requiring Timothy Peters to bring any money to the table, put him in a car, and was running for a championship. They ran for the championship last year. But here's the thing. They're looking at like $3 million a year just to be able to run a truck. $3 million. It's insanity. It is complete insanity. And it's because they're having to prepare all these trucks and invest in all the engineering to go to all these mile-and-a-half racetracks that they go to. Here's the thing.
That's what the truck series lost sight of what it started out to be.
God dang it, Craig. Stop interrupting me. I'm on a roll here. But that's, you know, that's,
just trying,
that's what it is.
I'm watching out for your blood pressure,
Eric. You know, that's what it is. The sport has just grown overinflated because at the national level, and at all, like, even at the K&N level, you're looking at $750,000 to run a freaking K&N car for a full season.
Let me ask you this. I don't want you to name names, but whether you're running Mazdas at Summit Point in the Mars series or you're running Legends cars up there, the funded teams seem to be running up front, don't they?
Yeah.
Every time, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, every time.
You know, that's a problem, too.
Huge problem.
Money buys speed, but if you have properly written rules, you can dissuade a lot of that.
Yeah.
But as far as the truck series goes, look, remember when the truck series came out? When the truck series came out, it was mostly on short tracks. They had a break halfway through the race.
Yeah.
We have guys from Old Dominion bought a truck and would go with two guys with them and run a truck race. You can't do that now.
Dickie Boswell. So,
Mike Colabucci.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's come up recently is NASCAR's, you know, started to look at adjustments to the schedule in the truck series. And, you know, a lot of the fans continue to harp on things that I've been harping on for years. And that is, you know, the truck series and the Xfinity series really need to take a look at getting back to their roots, getting back to racing's roots, getting away from running these companion events. Here's the deal. They run the companion events because the ISC and the SMI tracks are the only ones that can afford the sanctioning fee. If NASCAR, in their greed, were to lower the sanctioning fee, you're only going to have even if you bring in temporary grandstands at a place like South Boston, you're probably going to be able to put about 10,000 people in the grandstands.
Oh, wait a minute.
But think about how much people think about the TV draw that Eldora gets.
That's right.
The same TV draw that and that's a Truck Series race on a Wednesday night.
But
you will
run,
get that back.
We've run trucks at South Boston, and it was extremely successful. And
that's they packed the place, but they still couldn't afford the franchise
the sanctioning fee. The problem is the sanctioning fee.
Even the K&N races. Why do you think – I guarantee you.
That's why Dominion wasn't on the schedule.
That's what I was going to say. Why do you think Dominion wasn't on the schedule? Because Steve Britt probably lost a lot of money hosting that race last year.
He didn't put enough fans in the stands. That was his only deal.
All right. You are never going to be able to put enough fans in the stands to be able to cover the sanctioning fee. What covers the sanctioning fee is the TV money. That's what covers the sanctioning fee. Because that is how the racetracks are making all their money nowadays. It's the TV money. That is how they make their money. Like cup races, one cup race. Tracks are walking away with anywhere from $12 to $14 million, we think, based upon what we know to be fact in terms of how large was the TV deal and things like that. $12 million for one cup race for one weekend is what tracks are making off cup races. I don't know what the sanctioning fee is for that, but when you go and you look at the K&M Pro Series, sanctioning fee is probably somewhere around $35,000 to $50,000.
I heard it's between $50,000 and $65,000.
Yeah. So
it was $50,000 back when Hooters Pro Cup was a big deal. That's why Hooters Pro Cup got as many races. Yeah. They could sell it for $20,000.
But yeah, the problem is sanctioning fees. So go back to where we used to run South Boston, Myrtle Beach, Hickory, things like that. You're gonna, even though you're only gonna have 10,000 people in the grandstands because that's all you can fit, it's gonna look full.
Yep.
It's gonna look full, and people, and honestly, like for the first several years, those tickets are going to be hard to come by. If you go and you put an Xfinity Series race at some place like, I don't know, South Boston on a Saturday night, those tickets, simple economics, supply and demand. The tickets are going to start to be scalped.
And it's a great show.
People are going to want to go see it and things like that. But then you're going to have guys that can build cars that can take and go and enter a race and attempt to qualify and make the show. So that's why provisionals need to go away. But to have a chance to race on.
But one of the best melting pots I've seen as far as bringing in pro series to run against local guys is Central Pennsylvania. When they bring in the World of Outlaws or the USAC guys to sit there and run against the posse up there, the posse's it's not necessarily dirt racing.
What it is you have a geographical area where sprint car racing is really, really hot, and I think you have the same thing in Indiana, but yet you see the Outlaws go out on the West Coast and they run up and down the Pacific Ocean there, and they've got 16 cars, and if there's a big race somewhere else, all the local guys are going to go somewhere else because whatever it is with the Outlaws or whatever it is with the big race somewhere else, the Outlaws are hurting with the car count on the West Coast.
But what you're saying happens in the dirt late model world too. When the Lucas Oil cars make their swing through here, they get all the local guys as well as the guys you see on all their TV
races.
But
wouldn't it be grand if somebody could sit there and have a truck that they could run on a local regional level, okay, and then when NASCAR and the Camping World Series were to come in at a South Boston or a Myrtle Beach, that those same guys could compete and run against those guys.
Yeah, but the truck technology is already too far gone from that. You can't make them a local
car. That's the idea with the Welland Modifieds now, I think.
Yeah,
that's why they need to go back to running those short tracks, because what it's going to do, what it's going to do is it's going to devalue the current state of the sport. Where you have teams like Kyle Busch Motorsports, based upon what we know from the lawsuits against Justin Boston and everybody else, that it's Kyle Busch Motorsports was around $3.5 to $4 million a year, right, to run a freaking truck program. So here's the deal: you go back to your roots, and what's going to end up happening is you're going to have 40 trucks show up every week, right? So what's going to end up happening is because it's no longer 30, right now they're lucky if they get 32 trucks a week, right?
Yeah.
So what's going to end up happening right now, those teams, because there's only so many teams that are locked in the show, that Kyle Busch Motorsports says, oh, you want to come run a truck this weekend? It's going to be $150,000, right? People are like, I don't have that freaking kind of money. So what's going to end up happening is you go back to the short tracks, like a South Boston, you have people that are able to go buy shocks and everything else that they need, and they can build a truck for $25,000, $30,000 minus a motor, and then they're going to be able to rent that truck out to somebody that's been approved by NASCAR to say, hey, you know, by Brett Bodine to come and run a national series event, truck series. And you're going to have a guy that says, well, here's a truck that, you know, I've got all the best stuff in it. Kyle Busch is going to charge you $150,000. I'll charge you $15,000. So it's just naturally simple economics. It's going to drive the cost down.
Eric, we don't see enough of you here. And you're on such a roll and fired up. I would like, can I change topic with you and ask you a question about something else?
Talk about anything.
What do you think of the charter system? Does that help or hurt?
I'm glad it doesn't exist in the other series. I think there are too many charters. I think there should only be 16 charters, and I think that they should be good for 3 years.
What I'm hearing is that what happened is that they've cut the purse in half for the teams that don't have charters and aren't guaranteed a starting spot. It doesn't pay to start and park anymore.
It doesn't. And it also, the other thing is they've taken away the money from some of the Truck Series teams and the Xfinity Series teams to be able to pay cup purses.
And I thought it was quite, I'll use that word I've used a few times tonight. It was kind of ironic, some of the people that NASCAR paraded in front of you, like Tommy Baldwin, to show you, here, look how he benefited from the charter.
Oh, he benefited.
He benefited. But you'll never see another Tommy Baldwin, because Tommy Baldwin scraped his money together to start his team and had to run start and parks to keep building on it.
I mean, I remember several years ago, Barney Visser, 10 years ago, Barney Visser was a start and park team, and now he's running for a damn championship. It goes back to, like I said, the simple economics. I think that going back to the short tracks would be healthy. It would help. I think it would. I think the sport needs to contract in order to be able to grow again. So,
do you honestly believe that the guys at the top of those series, the big money guys, are going to let that happen?
They may not have a choice, because they may not have a sport left if they don't let it happen.
Right, but that doesn't seem to bother a lot of other sports like that. You mean, you run it until it's dead.
But once it dies, something else will come along to take its place. The tracks are still going to be there.
Right. I mean, that's what I see as the logical progression, is that it gets killed off and something comes in that's affordable for whatever time it takes, so that hits where the other one was.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't see another major stock car racing national series coming in to replace NASCAR. No.
Here's but I will say,
You're talking about the different divisions.
Yeah. But I will say something here. Late model stock cars are well past the point where they shouldn't even be your weekly car. They should be a touring series. They're beyond the point that the old late model sportsman cars were when they became the Budweiser series, which is now the Xfinity series.
Yeah. But here's the deal is, you know, when you have Xfinity Series drivers showing up and standing at the racetrack in a $3 million Prevost motor coach, that's you're too far removed. And, like I said, it'll contract and the sport will be forced. I think we're looking at probably in the next – I think maybe not – obviously not 2018. I think 2019 we'll see – I think NASCAR is going to be in a position where they're going to be forced – to reduce the sanction fees, to go back to the smaller tracks, to be able to help develop and grow a fan base around drivers. Because that's one of the things, is like the fans don't have a driver. We've talked about this also. Like, fans don't have a driver that they can relate to. Fans can relate to the guy that has grease underneath his fingernails, and you don't have that anymore.
Because the kids don't even stick around long enough locally to have a fan base.
But that's what the fans want. They want that guy that they can relate to ultimately. But speaking of guys that fans can relate to, Bubba Wallace. That kid can drive a freaking race car.
I hope he does well with the petty car, because he doesn't have his Xfinity ride.
Yeah,
now.
So to set that up, Darrell Wallace Jr., known for a while in NASCAR as Darrell Wallace Jr., but known to all of us that have known Bubba Wallace from Legends Cars and Bandoleros. And the kid finally won his first super late model race down at Bristol a few weeks ago. But Bubba Wallace... is going to be replacing, making his first NASCAR Monster Energy Cup Series start this weekend at Pocono Raceway, driving the number 43, the famed 43 for Richard Petty Motorsports, substituting for the injured Eric Almirola.
How do you think he'll do?
Mid-pack. No, that car is simply, it's a...
As far, but as far as his driving, you think he'll keep his nose clean and just, you know, bring it home running?
I think so. I think I think Pocono is a pretty challenging racetrack, and he's only been there three times, I think.
Yeah.
Twice in the truck and once in the Xfinity Series cars last year.
Yeah.
But I think that I don't worry about Bubba Wallace in turn three because he's used to that. I worry about Bubba Wallace at the entry into turn one at Pocono.
Okay.
Just because the amount of speed that you carry in there and how much you're having to whoa the car up, I think that's where I worry about because he doesn't have much experience in those types of situations.
That's right, because the Xfinity cars last year were so stuck to the ground everywhere.
But, you know, I think he's as good as anybody in that series mid-pack and back.
He could be a cup driver.
Bubba Wallace, talent-wise, is on the same level as Ryan Blaney.
I mean,
and they're good buddies, by the way.
They live together.
Bubba Wallace is a very, 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 very talented race car driver,
and he
has been from the time that he was a kid, and you know he comes from a hardworking family that is well off, not. You know, he's not a kid that's a Prevost Motor Coach kid flying to the racetrack every weekend. But his dad worked his ass off to be able to put him in the right situations in Legends cars, to be able to get his name out there, and it worked. And I think he's experienced some growing pains because he feels like he's been slighted for rides. I think, obviously, he was in a situation. You know, Darrell Wallace Jr. was the odd man out at Joe Gibbs Racing when Daniel Suarez came along. And
Suarez was bringing money, big money.
And that's what it was. So, you know, the Carlos Slim money.
That's a business decision.
And you can't fault him for it. But the thing is Coca-Cola should have been behind Bubba Wallace.
I agree.
Got behind Bubba Wallace and ensured that he was in a quality car at Joe Gibbs Racing.
On my way over here this evening, I heard Bubba Wallace on another show, and he's aware. I think he's going to do fine. He wants to make a good impression and not tear stuff up, basically.
I think that's his challenge, and I think he's probably capable of doing it. And Pocono, I think, is a wide enough, big, open track that he could probably stay pretty clean.
But it's fast, and with the lower downforce, there's even more braking going into turn one, so it'll be a challenge.
I think his big thing is going to be managing. I mean, it's 400 miles. Thankfully, it's not 500. It's not going to be too stinking hot up there this weekend. But I think being able to manage the outer bead on that right front tire going into turn one at Pocono is going to be his biggest challenge, because that is traditionally where we do see all the tire failures, and those tire failures at Pocono come from overdriving the car on entry.
What do you think that's the problem with Dover, or was it a camber issue?
It's camber, but it. It's tied to the bead, so too much camber.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. Because some people were trying to blame Goodyear, and I'm like, whoa! If it was Goodyear, everybody would have had the problem.
It was the teams.
Let me shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about the manufacturers. Okay, we've talked about Joe Gibbs having a Toyota in general must have an off season, but Ford, and we all know that Ford dumped a bunch of money a few years ago, kind of shifted their motorsports money around. I'm really surprised of the pecking order now in Ford changed so rapidly, in my opinion, okay? I mean, Penske's always the number one guy. He's not having a real good season, okay? Now, let's just say
leading a bunch of laps.
I know, but let's say Brad Keselowski's had some bad races. Let's just put
they're
it that
way.
Logano is the one that's having bad races right now, but ever since they got that damn penalty after Richmond. But, you know, you're right. Roger Penske is the premier Ford organization.
And who's number two?
Stuart Haas.
Absolutely.
And it's been that way ever since Penske shifted from Dodge to Ford. That has been the pecking order. And it's Doug Yates is just the guy that builds the motors, thankfully, and because Jack Roush acquired Robert Yates Racing stuff several years ago, that's why it is Roush Yates Performance. But, you know, Ford, Obviously, yes, they have dumped a lot of money into their program, and my favorite story with Ford right now is what they've done with the Wood Brothers, with Team Penske, and with Ryan Blaney. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to talk about, oh, it's Wood Brothers. Oh, it's, yeah, like Glenn and Leonard Wood and those guys own the car. I'm using air quotes for those that can't hear me or see me right now. But you know, while that is a Wood Brothers racing car, that is a Team Penske prepared car, and Roger Penske has a extremely well vested interest in ensuring that Ryan Blaney is in the best equipment, and Ford is at the forefront of that, ensuring that he's in good equipment.
Speaking of Ryan Blaney, two broken axles leaving pit road in two races in a row. Is that a faulty batch of equipment?
I think they were trying something.
Okay, gotcha.
I think that what they were doing was they were playing with the truck arm mounts, and when the car dropped off the jack and you know, the driver drops the clutch, that it just
the stress,
the amount of torque just snapped it.
Now, the Barney Visser team is now a Toyota, correct?
Yes.
And it's associated with Gibbs.
Yes.
So why is it that this single, well, two-car team now, operation out of Denver, Colorado, that's a satellite Gibbs team, is so outperforming all the Gibbs teams?
All those cars are built and prepared by essentially Joe Gibbs Racing. There's a technical alliance there, and there's a like Chris Carrier in the team. Like the 77 team is the 20 Xfinity Series team from last year. They just moved them up, and so it I wouldn't. That's why I'm not like super worried about Joe Gibbs Racing, right? Is because, you know, Furniture Row, like, that is Joe Gibbs Racing. It's just a different car owner and a different number scheme and a different, you know, tax filing every year. But it's Joe Gibbs Racing.
Well, I just find it interesting that team out of Denver on paper is outperforming the four teams out of Mooresville.
But those cars are prepared. Those cars are built. Those cars aren't built in Denver.
Oh, I understand.
They're built in Charlotte.
They're out the back door.
The team, the engineers work out, like, they're in their competition meetings are in Charlotte. Some of the road crew guys do, some of the road crew mechanics do work out at Denver, but most everybody is in Charlotte, Monday through Thursday.
It's kind of like just putting your name on something as opposed to actually doing it from coast to coast, top to bottom, bumper to bumper. I mean,
like McLaren on Alonso's Indy entry.
Yeah, right. Where's everybody going this week? We only got a couple minutes left. Craig?
I think I'm going to Dominion. I understand they got a 100-lap feature in store, and the weather ought to be perfect.
Lincoln for sprint cars, if I can make it.
Dominion Raceway spotting for David Pullins.
Cool. Oh,
this very weekend. Cool. So,
the Lechner car.
Yep, the Lechner Ford Fusion.
Yeah.
It's David's first race of the year. He tested last Friday at Dominion. It's a brand new car. It's a Hamke. Where's the Hopkins? I think it's a Hamke. Anyways, brand new chassis that saw the racetrack for the first. Well, it's brand new to David. It's actually a used chassis, but we'll see its first laps in competition this Saturday at Dominion Raceway. So we'll be down there. Got a brand new headset. Courtesy of Racing Electronics. I got the fancy ones.
Nice.
Looking forward to that. And then trying to finish preparing my car to race next weekend at Summit Point. So.
Cool. I'm down this weekend, but I'll be at Summit Point the following weekend for the Mars Series, and I'll be at VAR the weekend after that for the Porsches.
Lucky.
Michael, doing anything?
No.
Graduating from high school, congratulations.
Yep, got that next Tuesday, so I'll be prepared for that.
You come to Dominion on Saturday, hang out.
Yeah, I'll just have my grad party at Dominion.
Not good. A bad idea. Go-karts and all.
That'd be cool.
That's cool. Charlene and I are leaving next Thursday morning. We're going to Thunder Valley for the NHRA Thunder Valley Nationals. It'll be my first NHRA event. I did not go to Englishtown. I'm not going tomorrow. I don't know why, but I'm just not going. And so we'll be heading to the NHRA event. I think that's our modus operandi is a lot of variety or Lincoln. it was so strange, Dave, before we go off the air, being at Lincoln, J.R. Shepherd comes in, right? I never saw him. He goes over and he sits on somebody's hauler. He's texting me. He says, hey, man, thanks for the pass. And I says, "Are you coming over? I got reserved seats. You're seating in the Reininger seats." He goes, "I ain't coming over. I'm on top of a hauler, dude, drinking beer." I'm like, "Okay, fine." So we sat there with nobody around us for the World of Outlaws, and it was kind of like, this is pretty strange. But
Was it packed?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was probably 95% packed. And it was really extremely nice weather, and the show was good, and the posse got their butt whipped every race that week.
You need to be, the way you've been working with the camper and stuff, you need to be talking to Camping World about sponsoring you.
I'm having some fun. I need a new truck already.
I'll just say this, that camper you bought was right on time.
Let me tell you, I could live in the damn thing. You know, last weekend we went up to Harper's Ferry just to kind of air it out before we go on another long trip, and she looked at me Saturday morning. She said, "So what are we going to do today?" I said, "We're going to Carlisle." She goes, "What's a Carlisle?" I said, "All Ford Nationals." Well, it was like Mustang heaven. As a matter of fact, before I go off the air, Hearst Company, remember Hearst, not Hertz, the rental car company, Hearst, the shifter company, mm-hmm. built a bunch of cars back in the 60s. And I got into an argument at lunch with a guy over a cheesesteak telling me, no, Hertz only built black cars. I said, "No, I'm talking Hearst." He goes, "No." I said, "Linda Vaughn, Hearst Shifters." This guy's older than me. So I had to pull up on Google and show him. I'm talking about this car, dummy. Well, anyway, they had a Ford Mustang.
Olds 442.
Olds 442. They even made some Plymouths. Anyway, Hearst has gotten in bed with a company called Grand Spalding Sport, and they now build Hearst Mustangs. Mm. And these are really reasonable cars. And when I started talking to the guy, Larry Neighbors, who actually ran Grand Spalding Sport Dodge back in the 60s, is now building their cars out of a studio in California. And you can buy this car with a Kenny Bell supercharger at about 900 horsepower for $65,000.
Wow.
And this is one badass looking street rod. So, you know, we had a good time. A lot of Fords, a lot of Mustangs, a lot of crazy stuff. Pintos. Man, people still collect Pintos. Mm. I don't know what the deal is with
Mavericks.
I blew one up doing 70 miles an hour on the Thurber's Avenue curve, well, 95 in Providence.
I thought every Pinto had basically been cannibalized for its motor for a Formula Ford car. You know, but
the motor in
that's
mind.
Not the case. So, you know, I don't know. It's going to be a good season of racing. We'll be back on the air. We'll get some glitches straightened out. I had some computer problems tonight for everybody who missed us on the stream. We'll put this up on the net. And no guests, no commercials. This is the way we rolled, you know, for Eric Jones. Dave Reininger back from Indy. Craig Murto, Ken Hills, Michael Schlodden running the board. This is Larry O saying, buckle up because we want you back the next show.
Keep the green flag flying.
In the Pits is an In the Pits LLC production. All rights reserved. In the Pits. In the Pits Media. The Fuel Line. The Motorsports Minute. And Motorsports Magic are registered trademarks. The executive producer of In the Pits is Larry O'Donohue. The technical producer is Bob Rapoli. Associate producer and social media manager is Shirlene Reif. Our webmaster is Jason the Juice Smith. Our head photographer is Susan DeVault. Marketing by the Loose Performance Group. Public relations by Brotman, Winner, and Fry. In association with Sage Communications. See you next week.